Welcome to the Cybersecurity Expert Podcast, where you learn from the best cybersecurity minds, helping MSPs become cybersecurity heroes for your small business clients. And now, here's your host, Cybersecurity Sherpa, Jennifer Pleem.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I have Danny Jenkins on the phone. Super excited to talk with him. He is the CEO of ThreatLocker, and most of you probably already know about them. They deliver cybersecurity tools and services to the MSP channel. So, Danny, I very much appreciate you being with me. I know your schedule is tight. So, how are things going for you?
Things are going great, thank you.
Awesome, awesome. I appreciate you being here today. So what is fun for me is when we get on these calls that we have a chance to chat for just a couple of minutes in the green room before we actually go live. And you and I were talking about the layers of security and some of the terminology that is thrown around, but not always defined. And sometimes it is thrown around by multiple vendors and they're not using the same term the same way. So I thought we could start today by going back to some relatively common buzzwords in security, but they're words that aren't necessarily familiar inside of the IT channel for MSPs. And I wanted to start with zero trust, because I see that term, that phrase being thrown around a lot. And I think there's an assumption that everybody knows what it means and that everybody's using it the same way. And I'm not sure that's a valid assumption. So it's an unusual place to start, but let's start there and then we'll kind of see where the conversation leads.
Yeah, so the zero trust, the buzzword, the marketing buzzword, which is picked up by marketing people around the cybersecurity industry, is relatively new. It's popped up in the last few years. I think it originated from a concept that created by Forrester in how we should secure our environments. The idea of zero trust, taking away the buzzword, has been around for a long time, just at different levels of security. So going back into the 80s and the 90s, we created this concept called firewalls, where we no longer allow everything into our network. We close ports as needed. So we start with a deny approach, no trust, and then we add what we need at that level. Then it evolved in the late 90s, the early 2000s, where mail servers were no longer open relays, but now closed relays, and you could explicitly say who could relay mail from to them. And then we saw it in personal firewalls and elevation of credentials. And we've seen it evolve as a concept throughout the last few decades and how security has progressed. Because if we start with IT at the beginning, we're always about how do we make this easier? How do we make less friction? How do we make computers faster? And as we do that, that's great. And then we start adding problems and security and hackers and everything else on the back of that. So the concept of zero trust is simply deny all and allow it the least privilege possible.
Excellent. Okay, good. And are you seeing that definition of zero trust, which is a traditional definition, is that how all vendors are using the term zero trust, or is there starting to be some muddying of the waters?
It's incredibly muddy, like every single buzzword out there. AI is another one, but they love these words that they throw around recently. But essentially, we're seeing lots of vendors using it in complete wrong terms, where they're saying we zero trust no viruses. That's not really zero trust.
Interesting.
but yes, the word and the buzzword zero trust has been muddied. It's been exploited. It's being used by marketing firms to capture people's attention, and in many cases correctly, and in other cases wrongly.
Okay. So the concept at its most basic is we're going to deny everything, if you will. We are going to trust nothing, zero trust, and then we build in what we do think is okay. So we're permitting the good to run, and everything else that we haven't permitted, we are making the assumption is bad.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So why do you feel like that is a better approach to security than the opposite, which seems to be the norm, which is we're going to let it run unless there is something to tell us that it's bad?
So, and it's, well, the norm isn't working. So that's the first thing. And back in the 80s, 90s, people got into our networks through firewalls. They stopped doing that because we added firewalls. We added zero trust to our network infrastructure. Then they got in through concepts like sending executables through email, and then we blocked all bad files on email. And then they got into getting people to download things, run things, and then they got in through Zoom and Teams and Dropbox and all of these other ways. And we're constantly fighting to find these techniques and attack them. And I was at a conference a few weeks ago, back in the days when we went to conferences and we were in our Zoom rooms, in a ConnectWise conference. And I was talking about Zero Trust in application world. And I asked everybody in the conference, there was about 100 people there. I asked everybody who runs an antivirus, and everybody put their hand up, of course, because, and then I asked who here hasn't had a client with ransomware in the last few years. And two people in the entire room put their hand up. So I don't know if they were incredibly lucky or they just didn't have clients. So, but either way, it shows that everybody's running the technique of whether it's EDR or antivirus or whatever the buzzwords are there, some kind of threat detection technologies. And yet all of their clients, all of them at some point have had clients with ransomware over the last few years. So ultimately the traditional way doesn't work, or certainly doesn't work by itself.
So that's interesting. So instead of the whole cybersecurity always being reactionary and us reacting to threats and stopping threats or things that are purported to be threats, instead it's still reactionary in that we're saying, okay, is this good? I'm going to allow it to run, but you never in an ideal world, right? Because nothing is bulletproof, but you never have to really react because you didn't let the bad thing run in the first place.
So with the concept of zero trust, yes, you're saying nothing runs unless I approve it. And this has been a concept, this method is not necessarily new, even at the application level. It's used quite heavily in the Department of Defense and NSA and CIA and big government agencies that are regularly under attack. Because right now, if I send you an executable or a script or some kind of package, whether I get you to open it or I use a vulnerability, if your AV doesn't know what that is, it's going to get permitted. And AV is trying to look for bad behaviors. But the question is, what is the difference between Dropbox, which we want to run on our machine or may want to run if we use that in our business, and a piece of malware that replicates your data to the internet? The behavior is the same. So the idea of looking for bad behavior is not very good I'm not saying it's not good, but it's certainly not enough. So the idea of zero trust is we don't have to react anymore, because what we're doing is saying nothing runs unless we as a business collection, as an organization, as an IT department, approve this application.
Fascinating. So then how about those things like Zoom, that is a legitimate application, but recently it was used for ill intent, or Teams, or you know, something as basic as, oh, I thought it was a PDF and then I clicked on it. And so certainly things like that are legitimate tools, but they're being used when there are vulnerabilities, they can be used against us. So those tools were whitelisted, but now that tool was used against us. So how do we prevent against that?
Yeah, and every application has vulnerabilities, and it's a huge problem. And Zoom's getting beaten up right now. I actually say it's probably the most secure tool right now, because they've restricted it so much in the last week, you can't even copy and paste the URL out of the chat window. But every application has vulnerabilities, and we hope that by patching our machines, by the time the vulnerabilities become public knowledge, they've been fixed. We've already got the fix deployed, but quite often that fails. And it could be that there isn't a patch. So in the case of Zoom, it took Zoom a few days to fix that after the whole world knows about it. And we published a video showing how Zoom can be used. And it could be used in various ways. One is just sending pure malware through Zoom without any warnings for the user. They could click on a link and they could open a piece of malware. It could encrypt their files. And if it was unknown malware, their AV had no chance of detecting it. And of course, the application control, the ability to whitelist and control what applications can run, would stop that. But then you could also send in fileless payloads. You could call PowerShell, which is on your whitelist that isn't a malware, and you could actually access that, or you could steal credentials by connecting to a network share and get them to send on NTLM information to a network share and harvest their username and password. And that's where we have to go beyond just saying what can run and what can't run. Because the reality is, when you run something on your computer, whether it is Zoom, whether it's Office or Angry Birds because you want to play a game, or Chrome, that application has access to everything that you have access to. You don't have to be a local administrator for that application to encrypt your files on your file server, or to copy data, or to embed itself somewhere inside your user profile. So the first thing we want to do, of course, is to stop anything that we don't need in our business from running, because if it cannot run, it can't be exploited. And that's step one. So don't let your users download Chrome extensions freely. Don't let your users download programs and executables, because it's very, very easy to get tricked into run something that's malware. And you don't have to be an administrator to run it. But then the second stage is, once something is running, we want to define what it can and cannot do. And that's where we have this concept called ring fencing, which is quite is unique to ThreatLocker. And the idea behind ring fencing is not like traditional sandboxing, where you put it in a box for 30 seconds, then you let it out if it doesn't do bad, because you just wait 30 seconds before you do bad. Sure. So, but the idea behind ring fencing is that we say, okay, I'm going to let this run, but I'm going to put perimeters, I'm going to put fences around it to define what it can do. So if you open QuickBooks, QuickBooks needs to access my QuickBooks share. It doesn't need to access anything else. So if QuickBooks was compromised, the amount of damage it can do is limited to the data it's got access to. If I open Office, that probably has more access, but it needs to access my shares, my file shares. But doesn't it need to access PowerShell, or does it need to access RegServe or RunDLL or any of those other weaponizable tools built into your operating system? So you can ring fence these applications and say, these are the sites you can go to on the internet. These are the sites you can access. These are the TCP IP connections you can make. These are the files you can access, and that's it. And it sounds a little bit terrifying, but it really isn't. And if you look at vulnerabilities like the one in November, where an attacker could run a PowerShell command right from Internet Explorer, or the one last week where you could send fileless malware through Zoom, ring fencing, while not an excuse not to patch your systems, because you should patch your systems, blocked both of those attacks and many other attacks, because if you limit what it can do, you limit the amount of damage it can do.
Excellent. All right. Fascinating. I love this concept. Okay. So then the ThreatLocker solution, is that something that's layered beside an endpoint solution in place of it? Like, where does your solution fit in the layered approach or the cybersecurity stack?
So we block application whitelisting and ring fencing blocks ransomware. It blocks malware, and it blocks TeamViewer if you don't want it, or anything else potentially dangerous that could be in your environment. And it's very, very effective at blocking that, more so than an antivirus could ever be. But I would never consider it a replacement to an antivirus, because what it doesn't do, we are not a judge or a jury. We will tell you that this is TeamViewer. It's truly TeamViewer, and we've verified that it's TeamViewer based on the version downloaded from the internet. But what we won't do is say whether you should run TeamViewer. That is up to you. You as your business decide, do we want this application in our business? So we don't replace an antivirus, in that we wouldn't stop you from permitting ransomware as an MSP. If you wanted to allow ransomware on your client servers, you may want to reconsider your career opportunities, but we wouldn't stop you doing that. And we wouldn't stop you running TeamViewer or Dropbox, unless it's not on your list. If it's on your list, you choose as an IT company, as an MSP, as the person ultimately responsible for protecting your client system, what runs and what doesn't run. And so we do typically layer with an antivirus. Of course, it takes tremendous amount of pressure off the antivirus. And if you're considering, do I want to upgrade my antivirus to a more expensive antivirus that hopefully does a better job versus using whitelisting and ring fencing, you definitely want to choose the whitelisting and ring fencing. If you can put all of them together, great. If you can have a full EDR solution and whitelisting and ring fencing and a threat hunting system, that's a great opportunity. But because we don't replace any of those, but it is equally a really important part of your stack.
Excellent. Yeah, that's phenomenal. I appreciate that because there is so much confusion about what pieces are enough and how many layers do I need, but how many layers are too much. And it just becomes, it's a muddled mess out there trying to understand that. So let me throw this at you because I'm sure some people that are listening are a little skeptical and probably some of them are a lot skeptical because the last time that they tried whitelisting was maybe 4 or 5 years ago and it was clunky and difficult to manage and frankly not very effective at what it was supposed to be doing. So what has changed in 5 years that has made application whitelisting be something that is worthwhile looking at and analyzing at this point in time?
So I'm going to start by really defining what application whitelisting is, because there's another word that gets buzzed around a lot. It's not a whitelist against your antivirus. It's not a whitelist against what can be installed. It's a whitelist of every single DLL and script file that can run, whether it's at a kernel level, at a user level. 5 years ago, this question I asked myself, what is wrong? Why can't I get people, as a security professional, as a ethical hacker, of someone who's trying to get people to secure their environments, why can't I get people to buy into the concept of whitelisting? There was products out there then. And the problem was they didn't want to put the resources into it. Now, back then, my opinion was shut up and take your medicine. I don't care if you want to, you don't have a choice. You have to change your oil in your car. You have to put gas in your car. And if you don't do it, your business isn't going to function. And I was constantly hitting these brick walls and I was always trying to find better solutions. And that's where ThreatLocker came about. We started off as a pure whitelisting player and we wanted to deal with the three big complaints, the three big reasons people said, I don't want to use whitelisting. The first reason was it's going to take us too long to deploy. There's 20 to 60,000 files on every computer and just cataloging that is a nightmare. So we said, well, that one's easy. We catalog, we index, we give you a list of the applications, we tell you the files, you check the boxes. We can do that. We nailed that part down. I say it's easy. It required a lot more code than I initially thought in my head. But so we dealt with that issue and we created a really seamless system to deploy this, figure out what's running in your environment, see who's running it and decide very simply from a quick list of programs, which ones I want to choose. The next part of it that was really challenging was, oh, that's great, but what happens when Microsoft releases an update next month or Google or Adobe Reader or ConnectWise Automate or one of the other 200 or 300 common apps that just update every time we open them on our computer, Zoom included, updated 4 times in the last 2 weeks. That's great. Now I'm using whitelisting and there's 50 different files, or I don't know the exact number, 40 different files in Zoom. And every time it updates, I now have to go and whitelist all those files. And that's going to frustrate the user because we have a podcast at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock or whatever time it is. And we want to make sure it's going to work. So we said, okay, well, that's the harder challenge. But we set out to deal with that problem. And we didn't deal with it the typical way, saying, well, you can whitelist the folder, you can whitelist by name, because that's just dumb. And it just allows people to bypass it. We said, well, we're going to build a team. We're going to build technology behind this. So when Microsoft releases an update, when Zoom releases an update, or any of the 200, 300 different apps we've got in our database, we're going to automatically or manually, in some cases, download those updates, extract the files, get the hashes, and update the definitions. So as a company, when you permit Zoom, you don't have to worry about the next version being blocked. If you want to block the next version, that's fine. But if you want to say, allow future versions of this program, you can just check the box. We take care of the hashes. And we have a huge team that does that. We have a huge resources that do that. So you, as the MSP, don't have to do it. And that's ultimately been ThreatLocker's key success. 25,000 files a month on average, Microsoft releasing Windows updates. And most of those files are not signed. Imagine Microsoft can't afford to buy a $1,000 certificate. We do that so you don't have to.
Got it. All right. So we have covered a lot, everything from application whitelisting to zero trust and defining some of these buzzwords that are often used but rarely defined. And I very much appreciate your time. So let me ask you this. You spent a little bit of time talking about ThreatLocker and the various ways that you can support the community. Can you share some contact info or the best way for someone to reach out to you if they would like more information?
Yeah, so if you go to threatlocker.com, you can schedule a call right on that website. And there's a schedule a web demonstration on the homepage. There's a pre-recorded one if you'd want to watch it in your own time, and you can just schedule it. You can jump on a session with one of our engineers. So one of our engineers will join, one of our sales team will join you, and they'll help you explain how this can be used and how it's really viable for the MSP community as well, and how hundreds and hundreds of MSPs are using this and deploying this across their stack and really stepping up in the fight against ransomware.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for your time. I know it is valuable, so I appreciate you spending a few minutes with us. And I know that this will be extremely helpful for people that are continuing to try to navigate these waters and understand the various terms that they're hearing at virtual summits and trade shows to come. And so I appreciate the value that you've added today.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having me, Jennifer.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
To learn more about how you can become a cybersecurity hero for your clients, request your hero assessment today. MSPSalesRevolution.com/hero.